She's to sick bay. The doctor should look at it as soon as possible.
It is the way in which we propagate our species. Please demonstrate how this is accomplished.
So, what's next?
Hi, and welcome to Casual Trek, a Star Trek recap and ranking podcast brought to you by Nerd and Ty and the Genma Sao Tome School of Parenting. If they're alive, you're doing a good job. I'm Charlie Etheridge Nunn, a writer, and my favourite bad dad is, of course, Professor Charles Francis Xavier. Oh my god, so many children, so many dead children, and David Haller, who... yeah, is either neglected or dead or a cosmic entity. Who knows?
And I'm Miles Reed Lobato, a science fiction writer. And admittedly, I was going to say Genma Sao Tome as my bad dad, but Charlie beat me to it. So I'm going to go with my backup and say Gendo Ikari from the popular anime Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Oh, God.
Because who might just be the worst dad. Because his wife dies, he abandons his son for 10 years, starts orchestrating a plan to kind of evolve humanity into a single instrumentality so he can be reunited with his dead wife. But to do this, calls back his son after 10 years and goes, "Hi son, get in the giant robot or else Ray will have to pilot it again," thus causing a lot of emotional damage and trauma to his already emotionally damaged and traumatized son, Shinji Ikari.
Yeah, that's pretty bad.
He is the worst. But then Genma might actually be the worst because he sold his son for a food truck, which he promptly stole.
Yeah, I mean, it felt very reminiscent of my own childhood, to be quite honest.
But, you know, do you know who isn't a bad dad?
Why, who?
Son Goku from Dragon Ball Z. Okay, Goku's not the best dad, but at least when he's around, he's actively trying to, you know, teach his son good fighting techniques, and you know, he actively cares for his son when he's not dead.
Yeah,
Piccolo kind of does it better.
He does. He really does. Goku, I'm sure, is a lovely father when he's around, but he is very easily distracted by either a fight or someone just crinkling some paper or something.
Or food,
definitely food. Anyway, while we are tangentially about bad dads today, we are mainly about Star Trek, specifically three different Star Trek shows based around a theme, which we then rank on a big list of best to worst. And as fans of Star Trek, but, you know, fairly casual ones, that objectivity means that we are the best voices on such a task. And this episode, we're having a look at a topic nominated by Sean and Selle from our last episode. It's Sarek, the baddest of all the Vulcan dads. Before we go on, though, Miles, what non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Well, Charlie, you know how at the beginning of the show, we tend to mention that we are writers?
Why, yes.
Despite the fact that I don't think either of us have made a livable income from writing ever. I think the most I've ever made out of writing has been $200.
Okay. I've possibly made more than that in total, unless you count my comic Kickstarter, in which case I have lost money. Yeah.
So, guess what? I've been writing this last week.
Ooh. What have you been writing?
I have been writing a Sword and Planet short story as part of like a monthly writing challenge for this Discord I am on, and I'm having a lot of fun. It is just pure pulp with monsters and sword fights and stuff, but it's just been kind of just fun.
Nice.
To write something, you know, which unless like, yeah, I'm just going to have a character, you know, jump around and quip and attack robots with swords.
Excellent. Yes, my upcoming comic, Past Futureman, is very much in that kind of space swords and sandals kind of thing. Of like, yes, let's get someone who is, you know, I'm not creating a deep, convoluted continuity. There are things that may pop up again, but just having some rollicking fun and, yeah, some nice adventures. So, yeah, it's good to hear that you're doing that.
And Charlie, what about you? What non-Star Trek thing have you been enjoying?
Well, I've been breaking the back of my quest to play all the core Mario games. Originally, I wanted to get the first three done in January, because when I've idly tried this sort of thing with games like Legend of Zelda, it's the NES ones that really get me and that really kind of cause a bit of hesitation, and then I'm just bored and move on. And I came close with Super Mario Bros. 2, which some of it's good fun, but some of the bits can be a real faff, even with the rewind ability of the Switch.
Now, this is the Western Super Mario Bros. 2, which is actually a reskinned Doki Doki Panic, and not the Japanese Super Mario Bros. 2, better known in the West as Super Mario Bros. The Lost Levels.
Yes, you nerd. That's the one. As it is technically Super Mario Bros. 2, I'm playing that rather than The Lost Levels. I'm not a masochist. But once I finished that one, I started playing Super Mario Bros. 3, and oh my god, it's been such a joy. Some of it has been a little fiddly in places, but you can really see the DNA which advanced to Super Mario World, which is possibly my favourite of the 2D Marios. It's definitely the one that my brother and I played the most when our dad used to rent us a SNES from the video box up the road.
Super Mario World just has... It has, I would say, like the most replayability of the Mario games, because it has all the different secret objectives and levels to unlock. And I did manage to do most of that as a kid. I can't remember, Jack, whenever I played it as an adult.
I have the muscle memory for Super Mario World, but only every other level, because my brother and I used to switch playing each level as Mario and Luigi. So, yeah, it will be interesting experiencing every other level for the first time. Yeah, so with all that out of the way, our first episode featuring the baddest of the dads, Sarek, is actually the most recently aired one, but I figured we'd go in chronological order for these. So this is Star Trek Discovery Season 1, Episode 6, titled Leth. Lethe?
I think it's Lethe.
Lethe, okay. Lethe. It aired on the 22nd of October 2017, written by Joe Minoski and Ted Sullivan, and directed by Doug Arniakoski. The UK number one hit was Post Malone with Rockstar, and the US had Cardi B with Bodak Yellow, brackets, Money Moves. I'm old.
I'm old as well.
Yeah, these made me feel that. I mean, the video for Post Malone, who sounds like your friend who made Getting Stoned their entire personality for like 10, 20 years and is now on some like tranquilizers as well. Like the video trying to be a sort of Kill Bill sort of thing was such a jarring combination that I kind of admired it for that. And Cardi B was fine, but it felt like it kind of plateaued and went a little too long.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Charlie.
Yeah.
Is she Cardi B? She really wants us to be aware of this fact.
Apparently,
in the song.
I'm not sure what happened to Cardi A.
Professor Charles Francis Xavier.
Oh, no. Oh, God. Well, that's unfortunate. I expect we'll be seeing a Cardi C soon enough then. But before then, I will get recapping Lethe.
Oh, do you know who I should have put as my bad dad?
Oh?
Dr. Venture from the Venture Brothers.
Oh my god, again, such a bad dad.
Although he is a caring father, he is also a terrible father.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, Professor X always feels guilt when any of his students, fostered kids, or actual son dies, if he is aware of it. The problem is, a lot of the time, he really isn't.
Do you think Professor X needs to be tested for adult ADHD?
Probably, actually. He does move on from project to project kind of blissfully a lot of the time. Oh, well. Anyway.
All right. So, enough about our subtle parental issues. Charlie.
Yes.
As always, you know, because we're not Section 31, we're not relaying anymore. You have 5 minutes to summarize this episode.
Okay.
Right. Charlie, are you ready to dive deep into someone's psyche and find out how their father figure screwed them over?
Always.
Fantastic. Go.
Yeah, previously, Klingon Game of Thrones, Captain Lorca gets captured, befriends a guy called Ash Tyler, played by that there Clem Fandango off of The Thing. Ambassador Sarak is heading off to Khankri for reasons so classified he won't tell his underling. Michael Burnham's on the Enterprise, jogging with Tilly, pushing her, saying specific things she needs to do to get promoted and go up to captain. And if she doesn't follow them, she's fucked. Lorca and Tyler are blasting Klingons and broing out in some kind of hologram deck. I don't remember that from Kirk's Enterprise. Anyway, Lorca says he appreciates Ash and wants him to be the head of security for Discovery. Over on Sarek's shuttle, his underling reveals he's a logic extremist! Oh no! He hates the Federation, and then he explodes. Michael is backseat driving Tilly's breakfast order now, when she gets interrupted when Tilly spots hot new hire Ash Tyler and introduces them both to Ash, and then Michael collapses. She hallucinates an injured Sarek on the floor through some kind of mind meld. She's flung for a dreamscape that's not a million miles away from Troy's one in Night Terrors, and in a flashback to Vulcan getting turned down for the Vulcan Expeditionary Group, and that she'll have to go to Starfleet, a land of little to no logic that Sarek doesn't seem to care for. Sarek notices her there and punches her out of the dream. Michael wakes up in sickbay and mentions her telepathic bond with Sarek, which is pretty big after a bombing by logic extremists where he helped her telepathically with a soul graft. A Vulcan from Starfleet confirms Sarek's currently missing in a nebula, and Michael wants to find him. He was going to a peace talk with a Klingon house at a neutral location, and this is going to be a real problem. The Discovery has a look at the nebula, which is lovely and colourful, but can't see him in it. So Michael suggests a synthetic mind meld with a neural enhancer, and Stamets fucking loves this idea. He reckons it's going to be like a psychic hit of speed, which it sounds like he's done. Admiral Cornwell shows up now. Oh, she's here to see Lorca. She's annoyed about this rescue mission, and about Michael, and about Ash Tyler. Lorca, though, is a damn rogue who doesn't play for the rules. He's sent most of these problematic people off on a shuttle with Tilly into the nebula, where Michael's angsting about how she's Sarek's failed experiment, and that's why his dream is doing all this. She goes back into the dream, sees Amanda giving her a gift, and apparently Michael's application has been rejected. The real Michael asks Sarek, why does he keep doing this, and why doesn't he want her there? And they have a bit of a fight, which is all nice and dramatic, until Tilly gets her out of the Matrix, because it's all getting a bit much. Cornwell and Lorca drink whiskey, and she reminisces on old times. He subtly covers he doesn't remember them, because, hey, we know from the future, it's not really the real Lorca. Anyway, she mentions that he's been acting weird lately, and he suggests a quick knee trembler, again, as a bit of a distraction. Tyler wants to turn back, and Michael wants to go back to the dream world. She's the protagonist, she wins. So she goes back in, asks Sarek what he's hiding. They do some whooshy chops, and Michael asks what she did to fail, and he says, oh no, I failed you. They watch Sarek talking to the Vulcan Expeditionary Group. Bitches that they are, they decided to only accept one of Sarek's experimental children, and he picked Spock. Sarek says, Spock rebelled anyway, so this choice was pointless, and he collapses with some bright green blood. They mind meld, and he wakes up just enough to find his transponder and turn it on. They've found him! Yay! Back on the Discovery, Cornwell touches Lorca's back scars and he freaks out, almost shooting her. Maybe he's not doing so well with the old PTSD, and he begs her to keep his ship, but it's not working. Sarek gets too wounded for the meeting, and Cornwell's going instead. She tells Lorca he's going to have to step down when she's back, and we know this is going to be a sticking point for events later. She's pretty doomed. Michael goes to see Sarek and tries to bond, but he's already repressed everything they've talked about this episode. Tilly's jogging again, and Michael says, maybe don't listen to me. There's more than one way to do a Starfleet. And Tilly says she knows. Michael then goes to have a drink with Ash, and she mentions for realization she and Sarek won't ever be close. Emotions, eh? God. Ash says, yeah, yeah, that's being human. And reintroduces. Oh, well.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Do you want to continue?
Yeah, I've got a little more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So before, while I'm getting the stopwatch set up, do you think Sarek has definitely eaten one of his own children? Just gobbled them up like a baby tiger. Like a
That's the first human child that we do not speak of.
Because, like, Sarek has Spock.
Yep.
Michael Burnham.
Yep.
And Cybok from Star Trek V. I'm not discounting that Sarek had a child in yet another marriage, because this guy is, like, I guess, a Vulcan Mormon.
Apparently.
And he just, like, just gave birth to the child, just picked it up and just went,
Nom. God, yeah, the little known thing that Vulcans could all detach their lower jaw. And, yeah, just, oh!
Just gobble it down like a hamster in the TV show V.
That one was a Klingon, a half-Klingon child, and I realized it would be very illogical.
Right, stopwatch, go.
Okay, so yeah, Michael reintroduces herself to Ash Tyler. Over on Kankri, Cornwell shows up for the peace talks. Only the Klingons here double-cross her. They kill everyone else and say, actually, we're pretty stoked you're here, because you'll make a better hostage than Sarek. Over on the Discovery, Saru's confused that Lorca's not going a wild card and making unorthodox rescue plans. And we know that he might not even want her rescued. Bom, bom, bom! The end.
36 seconds.
Okay. 36 is all right.
36 is all right. Don't you love it when prequel shows bring things up which no one should know about because it's highly secretive? I think things like Catra were like something kept very, very secret in Search for Spock, but everyone's just kind of talking about it here like it's a known thing.
Yeah, that whole kind of, yeah, it's kind of like a Vulcan soul with any of these kind of things. It's odd. Yeah, it does feel sometimes they need some kind of continuity editor, like a Mark Grunwald type or something. Or maybe look at Memory Alpha. But yeah, fine. I forgot how enjoyable Lorca was as a real bit of a shit of a character. Like, he features all the hallmarks of your general Starfleet captain, but is also obviously very dodgy. Kind of the way he's supporting and pushing people. It's like, yeah, to what, though?
It doesn't help that Jason Isaacs, while a fine actor, has a face which is less Dan Dare pulp science hero and more guy who's going to try and sell you a dodgy motor.
Yeah, yeah. TV budget, Doctor Doom kind of thing. You know, it's like, yeah, this is what you'd get if you were going, well, we do need to show their face, but we need them to look kind of charming but sinister with it. And yeah, like Cornwell, I'd mostly forgotten about. But yeah, it's interesting seeing that kind of him trying to cover for the fact that he's Mirror Universe Lorca, now that we know in retrospect that's the case. Of like, oh shit, yeah, he's obviously panicking and covering these bits, which was fun. So yeah, kind of add something. Oh, and this is the first episode of the Disco t-shirts, which I kind of like.
I do like as well. I kind of want one.
Yeah. The apparently the writers had no idea they were going to be made. It was just something the prop slot did, which is a surprise, because I would have expected them to have been a leftover element from when Brian Fuller was showrunning this. It feels very much his style.
Yeah. I mean, I would get one, then I would actually wear it when I'm working out.
Ah. Yeah.
In terms of wacky SF TV visuals, which I wouldn't feel out of place in, like, classic Trek or the 90s stuff, but just feels so left field when done on this much more serious, dramatic HBO Star Trek, is Michael Burnham being Matrix-chopped out of Sarek's dreamscape, and she flies off like she's just been hit in like a Dragon Ball Z move.
God, that whole sequence was amazing. That kind of whoosher Like, yeah, I think it was that they wanted to show off the moves of James Frayne or something. But yeah, it felt kind of out of nowhere, but just weird.
You know how we had the actress who played the Dalton in Section 31 who learned martial arts? I guess like the guy who got the role of Sarek was like, right, I'm going to be a Vulcan. That means I need to learn martial arts. And No, you're an ambassador, kind of a diplomat type. He's like, too late. I learned martial arts. I now need them implemented into the story.
Look, he's taken a lot of interest in humanity, if you know what I mean. So at some point,
I appreciate your burritos, your Mozart, and your Jackie Chan movies.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, maybe it would be like, yes, well, my fifth human wife was very much into Shaolin soccer. I found it very pleasing aesthetically.
Do you think that Vulcans would appreciate the mathematical precision of perfectly executed slapstick comedy? Even if they don't appreciate the comedy itself, do you think they would appreciate the setup and the timing to pull off the gag?
Yeah, because some of them end up feeling almost like you could set your watch by them, and I'm sure that consistency would be very approved of.
Just imagine a bunch of stoned Vulcans watching Scooby-Doo and just kind of looking at all of Fred's traps going, yes, very efficient, very logical.
Yeah, so it's interesting seeing episodes with James Frayne playing Sarek around the same time as seeing Mark Leonard playing Sarek, because both are very good at being just like, oh, you're a shit, just in all of these, and both of them are good actors, but fucking hell, Sarek, like the amount of times I'd find myself saying that under my breath watching these, just like, fucking hell, just you get that this is a human you're talking to, even though you raised her on Vulcan to be like a Vulcan, which is a human that's been contaminated by other humans. Just go, I acknowledge our previous conversation in The Matrix. And there you go. That's literally all she needed. Like Ash Tyler, with his conversation with Michael about fucking motions, eh? It was interesting seeing Michael being like, I'm kind of at peace figuring that I will never figure this out. Like, it's just always going to be an issue, me and Sarek. It's like, yeah, I know. I hit those points with both my parents at different times.
I've not watched, it's been a while since we've gone back and watched early season one.
Yeah.
Discovery. And it's weird seeing the much more Vulcan Michael Burnham than we get in the later seasons as she kind of breaks out of that shell.
Hmm. Yes, as fun as it was seeing season three onwards Burnham being allowed to emote and have a personality, it's like, I get that it's for effect. You know, it's like Olivia in Fringe, where the first season I kept thinking, is the actress just so wooden? And when you see her playing alternate versions of herself, when you see all of these different things, like when she's got Leonard Nimoy in her brain. So no, she's got range. She's playing a character that is purposefully understated at that point, and that changes.
Oh God, Fringe. That's what a show.
Yeah, that's what, 4 out of 5 good seasons.
Yep. I don't know, because then you have the thing of sometimes you end up playing up aspects of yourself. Like, I admit, when I'm out and about living in America, I am more British. Mm. And I mean more kind of stereotypically. I mean, I usually play a bit more like my work face. I'm usually a bit more posh than I am normally. Then with my mates, I'm just like, ah, you fucker.
I was talking to a friend of mine who listens to the show, and he was saying about kind of catching up with Casual Trek, because it was just after I'd been editing the Section 31 episode. And he was like, he was mentioning about how I have a podcast voice and saying, I think I sound more Brighton. on this, and he was saying, yeah, but also the longer you two go on, Miles starts to get it as well. It's like, wow, yeah, I'm gonna have to keep an ear out for that.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, yes, hello Ben, when you finally catch up to here.
I have a friend over here in the States, Remy, who like lived in Sheffield up until like they were like 8 or 9, and then lived in America, and they have a perfect American accent until they've been in the room with me for about 30 seconds, and then Sheffield just comes right back.
Yeah, it's difficult to get rid of. My brother's BFF Garrett he's from America but has lived here for most of his life now, and he's still got a very American accent until you hit the Brightonisms and suddenly those come in, it's like, oh wow, okay, that's that's interesting.
I've had that when I find myself using, because sometimes it is easier to just switch to the American word. I like saying gas, because I said petrol completely instinctively last week, and someone looked at me like, what? Like gas, sorry.
Oh, dear.
Or trash or garbage instead of rubbish. And
wow. Yeah, so I think we're running out of things to say on this episode of Discovery.
I mean, Sarek, what a bastard.
Yeah.
Although I do appreciate, okay, Michael's not getting into a first choice school, so she's going to have to go to Blatchington Mill instead of Stringer.
Wow.
At least she's not going to Decent.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, at least there's that. God, what would be the equivalent with that? Because, yeah, going, oh, well, I guess it's for backup, which is Starfleet. Like, filthy Starfleet. And all that. Like, at least we're not having to send a Vulcan to be part of it.
And then, meanwhile, Spock just goes, fuck you, I won't do what you tell me.
Like, hell yeah, rebel.
Drives, and then just does some mathematically perfect donuts on a space Vespa and does some backward Vulcan sass a la Lower Decks as he rides off to join Starfleet.
I would love that. Also, keep that in mind for our next episode. But that's probably how they last spoke. So, before that, where are we going to put this episode on the big board? Now, our big list has had a slight change lately. So it is standing at 148 episodes deep, starting at the number one spot. The best Star Trek is Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. The 50th Star Trek is The Assignment from DS9, where Keiko gets possessed. Our 100th place is What a Little Girl's Made Of from the original series, with the rock that's shaped like a dildo. In the 147th spot is the original series with Plato's Stepchildren. And last episode, we ranked Star Trek Section 31 as the worst on this list. However, it ended up being left in spot number 151, just on the baseline assumption that all of these are going to be better than it. So that's the obvious flaw, is the lowest point here. But what kind of error are we looking for this? So we've got a few discoveries here, and there are some fun bits. Like, I think magic to make the sanest man go mad in spot number 53 with Stamets chasing mud in a time loop is better than it.
Yeah. Oh god, let's have a look. I mean, this was actually a really good episode of Discovery.
It was. Yeah.
I feel like the one Star Trek show we kind of rag on more than Discovery is Picard. Mm-hmm. Picard knows what it did.
Yeah.
But like, this is really good. Plot, you got a solid B plot. Like, Stamets is being all high on spores is a bit weird and funny, and admittedly, I kind of want Tilly's breakfast burritos. They look really nice.
Oh dear. Yeah, I forgot Stamets was high during that. I was like, Stamets seems really enthusiastic this early in the show. So, oh yeah, that's why.
He's me like the first hour of my shift when I've had some coffee.
Yes. I miss being able to get that stoked from coffee.
Coffee! Yay! Okay. I am looking at number 60, which is DS9's Field of Fire.
Ooh.
When Ez calls on her dark, murderous previous life to help solve a killer in Starfleet on DS9. I feel...
Oh my god.
I feel this one is better. I like the character stuff. Laughing at the dumb martial arts, you know, karate chop out of a dream was a bit goofy.
But yeah,
it's a good...
See, when you were starting to make comparisons of things, I was like, are you going to talk about the Nebula? Because that was a fucking gorgeous Nebula.
The special effects for the Nebula looked great.
Yes. I love a freaky Nebula. Like, I remember when I'd be watching old Star Trek and it's all just space, just black with stars. And then you'd watch like an episode of Farscape and there's stuff everywhere. And yeah, that was always nice to see. Okay, so you're saying better than Field of Fire. Is it better than the Space Castle, though?
Ooh.
Like, it's not got a weird nebula, but it's our first meeting with Klingons. Yeah, you've got Renfair Castle.
You've got... That's Kor in the first.
Yep.
You've got Kor definitely trying to make himself like Kirk's big rival. And Kirk's just like, nope, shutting this down right now. None of that, thank you. And, you know, Kirk and Spock go on a little Metal Gear Solid mission. They, you know, punch out some Klingon. Like, I feel that this one needed a few more fistfights.
Yeah.
But no, I think as introductory episodes for what would become the most iconic alien baddie of the show, I feel that this one, Errand of Mercy, definitely deserves to keep its number 59.
Cool. So yeah, that puts this at episode 60. Well, I'm going to sip my drink. And then back in. So our second episode for the evening is Star Trek The Original Series, Season 2, Episode 15, titled Journey to Babel. This aired on the 17th of November, 1967. It was written by DC Fontana, directed by Joseph Pevney, and the UK number one hit was The Foundations with Baby Now That I've Found You, and the US had Lulu with To Sir With Love. I quite liked Foundations.
Yeah, I wish that this had been the closing theme tune for Apple's Foundation TV series.
That could be fun.
It's about as loyal to the books as the Foundation TV series seems to be at times.
Wow. I only made it 2 episodes in. I think my dad, who was also a big Asimov fan, said he tried watching the first episode a couple of times, fell asleep every single time. Which is a good sign.
Yeah, I watched the first episode. I'm like, this is good, and I always want to kind of, you know, give space opera shows on Western television a much more fair shake, because we definitely don't get as many as we would like.
Yeah, and it's got Lee Pace in it, who's always good fun.
Yeah, and like, there are some interesting ideas, like the clone emperor being like the older, the younger, and the kid. But I'm just like, this isn't Foundation.
Yeah.
Like, it does get away from some of the core concepts of the book really quickly.
Ah, well, but we're not here to talk about the Foundation. We are here to have you recap Journey to Babel.
What do you think about To Serve With Love?
Oh yeah.
Have you ever seen the film?
No, I didn't even realize it was from a film until I was looking for the video on YouTube.
Yeah, it's a fine film. You know, it's, you know, Sidney Poitier plays like, I think it's like a working class like engineer who, while between gigs, gets a job in like this common London grammar school and all that. It gets very condescending very quickly.
Of course. Wow. Yeah. No, I didn't realize. But yeah, the song was fine. I think I prefer Baby Now That I've Found You out of them. But yeah. That's right. So, you have 5 minutes to journey into Babel, starting now.
The Enterprise is on a trip to Babylon 5. That's right, they're on a journey to Babylon 5. That's right, Charles, you should never give me the chance to cap up this episode to discuss the admission of the Corridan system to the Federation. It turns out that a bunch of other Federation planets have been basically exploiting Corridan's wealth for their own. So it's a touchy subject about who wants Corridan in, who wants Corridan out. But they are stopping to pick up Ambassador Sarek of Vulcan, who is a big shot ambassador, and his wife Amanda. McCoy has trouble doing the Vulcan salute, and upon meeting Sarek and his human wife, Kirk goes, "Hey, Spock, we're leaving in a couple of hours. Do you want to beam down and say hi to your folks?" And Spock goes, "Captain, these are my folks. I don't want to talk about it."
Enter sitcom laugh track.
Kirk, McCoy, and Spock give Sarek and Amanda a tour of the Enterprise. Kirk keeps trying to get Spock in the conversation, but Sarek is shutting him down straight away. Sarek kind of gets a bit tired and goes to his room, telling Amanda, you deal with this. I'm too important for this shit. Amanda admits to Kirk that basically Sarek and Spock had a huge falling out over Spock joining Starfleet against Sarek's wishes, and so they haven't spoken in 8 years. There is a reception, and the Tellarite ambassador, who's called Gav, and acts like every guy I've ever met who's called himself Gav, is really getting into Sarek's face about what Sarek's position, and Sarek's like, look, man, we'll talk about it when we get to Babel. We're not doing this now.
Fucking Gav.
The Tellarites have been, is one of the people who have been illegally taking resources from Corridan, so the Tellarites want to protect the Tellarite interests. Meanwhile, Uhura picks up a mysterious transmission, which is coming from somewhere to the ship, but is leading to a ship they can't find. Meanwhile, Gav has been found murdered!
Not Gav!
Gav's dead! Murdered! And somebody's responsible. It turns out that that his neck was broken by an ancient Vulcan martial art called Tal Shiar, which sounds a little bit like Tal Shiar, but I'm sure that's a complete coincidence. And thus making Sarek, you know, the number one suspect. Kirk, Spock, and McCoy burst into Sarek's room and to interrogate Sarek, and Sarek promptly basically has a heart attack and has to get rushed to sickbay. Turns out that Sarek needs immediate surgery, but they don't have enough of Sarek's blood, which is a rare T-type. Not T-virus, but T-type blood. Spock has the same blood, but he's half-human. So there are some differences between his blood, and they need the blood in large quantities. McCoy thinks that he can use this medical technique to filter out the alien, the human bits of the blood, so they can give Sarek nice, healthy Spock blood. Amanda is torn, since this will basically leave both her husband and her son pretty dry on blood. Spock agrees to the operation and is like, well, I'll be here for my operation about half an hour. Hopefully nothing bad's going to happen. Cut to Kirk in a brawl with an Andorian in a hallway. It's going bad. Kirk uses his patented WWF wall jump to take out the Andorian, but the Andorian, he brought a knife to a wall fight and promptly stabs Kirk in the back. Oh shit! Spock is now in command. And unfortunately, that means he is too busy to take the operation. Sarek's gonna die. Amanda goes to Spock and says, Spock, you need to turn command over to someone else. Because, you know, if you don't do this, your father is going to die. And Spock's like, Mother, I have sworn an oath. I have to protect the ship, the crew, and all the delegates. This is not a situation where I can just pass this off onto Scotty. And Amanda's like, Spock, you're my son, and I love you. And I've always been there for you when you were being bullied at school.
Oh, dear. Right. So, he was bullying him at school. Wait, no. Wrong way around. Let's pick up the recap now.
Amanda was always there to comfort Spock when he was being bullied at school. Even though he has chosen a Vulcan way of life of suppressing all his emotions. And she's okay with that. But if he lets Sarek die, she will probably hate Spock forever. And Spock is visually, like, distraught in this. And when his mother storms out, he tenderly puts his hand on the door because he can't admit the emotions that are raging within himself. Kirk wakes up as McCoy is basically stitching him up. It's like, hey, why isn't Spock on the operating table right now? And McCoy goes, you realize that there was a knife in your back, right? Spock's in command, and he is not letting anyone be in charge. Kirk is like, right, McCoy, I've got a plan. Just stick some staples in me. Let's super glue that wound shut. I'll put on my cleanest green tunic, go up to the bridge, persuade Spock that I'm all right, and get him on the table before I start bleeding out. This is a plan with no drawbacks. So Kirk gets stapled up, basically all but crawls onto the bridge half dead. And Spock's like, Captain, are you okay? And Kirk is just visibly like not well. He's like, yeah, Spock, I'm fine. Go save your dad, okay? It's okay, old Jimmy T's got this. And Spock agrees and goes down to have the operation. Let's hope nothing bad. Oh, look, they get attacked by that mysterious ship. And Kirk is left to be in charge while they're being attacked. Spock immediately tries to get out to the operating table just as soon as he's arrived, because he's worked out how they can track the ship. And McCoy just promptly like drugs him out and starts doing a lot of surgery while the spaceship battle is going on. There's some points when they have to manually, you know, keep Sarek's heart pumping. Kirk is able to take out the ship. It turns out it's an Orion ship, and the Andorian who stabbed him is actually an Orion in disguise, hoping to disrupt the negotiations so they can just keep
nicking
stuff from the Korriban. The ship destroyed. The Andorian takes a quick time release painless poison, although he got that wrong and he dies in quite a lot of pain. McCoy has done open heart surgery on two Vulcans. He's definitely going to enjoy that brandy. Kirk gives command over to Scotty, is wheelchaired into sickbay and into bed. Meanwhile, Amanda berates Spock and Sarek for their being very logical in this situation. And Spock's like, women, a dad. And Sarek's like, well, I found it logical to marry her at the time. Kirk tries to immediately get back in the seat. And McCoy's like, nope, everyone in bed, because I finally got the last word out of everyone here. And this is truly Dr. McCoy's best day.
3 minutes, 26 over. And he looks so overjoyed.
I apparently that's an ad lib.
I mean, it looked a bit like an ad lib.
It looked an ad lib, but you know what? It's like, it's one of those great keep it in moments.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, fourth wall breaking as it looked. That sheer joy, because out of the Spock Kirk Bones thing, Bones almost always is the one to suffer through it all. But yeah, that was
like, as we saw in the Empath, if there is a fight between the three of them over who gets to sacrifice themselves for the other two, McCoy already probably has like two hypos full of drugs just to like double fist Kirk and Spock and take it on himself.
Just make sure you got the Vulcan strength one in the right hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like most of TOS, this is a first time for me seeing it. And it was like the first time that we see Andorians, the first time we see Tellarites, and of course, Sarek and Amanda, which, it's a lot of nice firsts. I think it's later on that Andorians and Tellarites are mentioned as like key founding species. But I also like that it wasn't, these people are an obvious monoculture that are just going to be dicks. Like every single one of them. It's like, no, it was some Orion pirate that was in disguise that was behind it all. So that was quite good. The outfits, though. I wanted to ask you what the best fit was there, because like just having a look on the screen captures, we have Sarek wearing like a blue jumpsuit suit, but with like a tapestry shield, like a medieval shield put in front of, like on his front, and some weird like sleeve, like drape things. The Tellarites appear to be wearing window pane as their aesthetic, like prismatic window pane. And looking at a screen cap here, the one in front got his nails did.
Oh, good for him. Good for him.
Yeah.
I like the imitation chainmail the Andorians are wearing.
Yes, under the kind of weird apron tabard thing with the swirly patterns on. There are two...
Those wigs, their hairstyle's a little bit...
It's a bit rough, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like the Andorians, like, but yeah, they look a bit... Kind of, the fact that they look a bit gaunt as well doesn't help.
I might have to say my favorite aliens are the weird little dwarf guys in the gold makeup and like the nice little wool fezzes.
Yeah,
I think it's actually Jeff and Akbar from the Matt Groening comic Life is Hell.
Oh my god! Wow. Yeah, I could see that.
Or Akbar and Jeff, you know, take your pick over which one is which.
Of course. Apparently, Manny Coto, when he took over showrunning season 4 of Enterprise, wanted to have these fellas in that, along with Tellarites and Andorians. Personally, though, the two guys in hoods, like the kind of like dressing gown hood, like long sleeve things with the blue. The yellow, the white, and the red stripes, and his mate with a kind of robe that's yellow with all these swirly patterns. Those, I thought, they look kind of comfortable. Like, if I was going to a function, I wouldn't want, like, a big thing. Something that breathes, but...
You want a comfortable onesie?
I mean, I still find the idea of a onesie weird, but... It is
weird. Like I have a Spider-Man onesie, which is really fun to wear at like a Halloween party, and wearing a Spider-Man t-shirt underneath, which looks like the chest of like the Spider-Man outfit, and then just pull down the onesie. Hey, I got a secret to tell you. Pull down the spider onesie. I'm Spider-Man.
Oh my god. Yeah, there's. A woman who's in like a blonde wig and a yellow suit that looks kind of D-light kind of look. And some medieval peasants? Maybe? Like, I assume they raided whatever they could costume-wise.
Yeah, it's like whenever you get to like the 70s or 80s era of Doctor Who, when they're clearly recycling costumes from the 60s and early 70s, and you're like, yep. I see some Sea Devil in there. I see some Axonites. That's definitely a Federation trooper outfit from Blake 7. What are you doing in Doctor Who, mate?
Yeah. So, yeah, for me, definitely the nice hooded robe looks quite nice and comfy.
But I think this is a favorite. In terms of a unit of Trek, I feel this has everything that makes classic Trek so amazingly iconic.
Yes.
You've got the core dynamic, you've got the banter, you have the pulp silliness, but then you also have like the drama of Spock's conflict and the scene where Amanda goes to confront Spock and he's got his back to her, but like on his face we just see every emotion from Leonard Nimoy as he's trying to hold in everything. Like the moment she says, I think I would hate you forever. And you can see that, like, Spock is just, like, one push to keep himself from weeping.
Oh, God. Yeah, DC Fontana did a very good job with this. Like, apparently she just took the previous references, which were just about how his mum was a teacher and his dad was an ambassador, and went, I want to do this. And that idea of having Amanda in the middle of these two. Like, all three of them get stuff to do and get fun interplay with each other and the crew there.
And like, you know, Sarek is a dick to Spock, but you have the scene which is just Amanda and Sarek, and he's just like, you kind of embarrassed Spock. I mean, he's an adult. He's a professional. These are his mates, and you kind of, you know, And they're clearly going to be ripping the piss out of him later. And at the party, guess what they're doing?
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, God, Bones just trying to find any ammunition. Like, oh, he had a teddy bear as a pet. So, yeah, but it was big and alive and had fangs. So, ooh, teddy bear. Like, it doesn't matter.
Like, this has those little moments. Like, I feel like you will get in TNG. Like, the bit with, like, McCoy not being able to do the Vulcan salute.
Mm.
And he has to kind of just literally push the fingers apart.
It's yeah, like, I've got friends for Con. And it's one of those things of,
yeah.
Easy enough.
I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a choice between this and being able to click my fingers, I'll take this because I can't click my fingers.
Oh, I can only click my right. I can't do the left. I don't know why. It just...
Yes. Slay Queen.
I need to turn it off and back on again, I guess, for the left one.
But I don't know. Like, I feel in terms of... You know, this has everything. This has, like, the grand high space opera stakes of the mission, but it's all just kept into the family drama of Bok, Amanda, and Sarek, and then the lengths that Kirk and McCoy are going to go to make sure that their friend doesn't commit patricide.
Yeah, like this early on, I know we saw Mark Leonard as a Romulan before this, but he is immediately Sarek. He is immediately so good as this. Like Jane Wyatt as Amanda's good too. Like from what I was reading, she thought that Star Trek was a comedy show and didn't realize how serious it all was. It's like, yeah, on this episode. So they ended up referring to her as Miss Jane Wyatt in the credits as a little nudge after that. But yeah, it's like, yeah, you can see it. As goofy as some of the things are, like the outfits and all that, it's still a good time.
Like, this is, I would say, this is all what makes Star Trek Star Trek.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have space stuff. But personally, I'm fine with that. Like, yeah. It's science fiction-y enough. And yeah, just the idea of going, yeah, you've got a fraught parental relationship, but it's the Vulcan. Yeah, the one that everyone goes, oh, they've got no emotions. So how the fuck do they process this?
Badly.
Yeah. Yeah, badly, it turns out.
I'll be honest. Do you know how they process this? They process it like the British.
Just repress it and then get real violent at one point.
Don't talk about it. Hold it down. Don't admit anything. And then maybe you can actually have a nice confession on a deathbed.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. That's where it all comes out.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. This was very good fun. So looking at the list, we've got quite a few high up TOSs. We've got things like 15's got Where No Man Has Gone Before. Where they kill God with a rock. 12 is, of course, Mirror Mirror.
I will be honest, like, for me, this might be a number one.
Woof.
Again, because, like,
pure
unit of track.
Hmm.
Like, I feel this is
God.
What this is the stuff that, you know, made, like, Star Trek eventually a cult hit. Like, initially a cult hit. Mm. But
if you go, like, it's going to look hokey, but this is a good... Like, if you want to introduce someone to a Star Trek, then, yeah, it's definitely a good one for that.
Like, if you want to introduce them to, like, the characters in the interplay, so, like, the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, like, triumvirate of these, you know, these are our heroes, warts and all.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, our top 10 at the moment, like, starts with The Trouble with Tribbles in spot 10, House of Quark and Where the Warrior. We've got Star Trek 3. We've got The Fun Old Time Loop for Next Generation in number 6 with Cause and Effect. See, I'm thinking, yeah, you are very much right about the quality of this as a unit of Trek. I'm kind of tempted to say possibly above Far Beyond the Stars, because Far Beyond the Stars is an amazing hour of television. But also, yeah, if we look at this as good TV and a good Star Trek, we've got that. Like, out of this, like, above that Strange New Worlds is pilot, which I think if I was introducing someone to Star Trek, I'd probably start with that rather than this, just because kind of sensibilities wise with the kind of look and feel of it, you can go, okay, we've got some people in the room, not we're having an ambassadorial lunch with some weird piggy orc guys. Which, you know, no offense to Tellarites, after all, like, Jank and Pog is one of the best modern Star Treks.
But also you can see Jank and Pog's eyes.
Yeah, yeah, that's, yeah. And there's Balance of Terror, which, again, really good Star Trek. Very, like, foundational, like, this is what it is kind of thing.
And, like, number one is Wrath of Khan, and then number two is DS9's Emissary. And, okay, yeah, this is, oh my god, this is good, but it's not Emissary good.
No, it is that thing of the top of the list is all so good. Like, most of these, I'm like, yeah, I could literally just be off this call and watching any of them.
Yeah, I am always down to watch Emissary. I can watch the I could watch the scene where Sisko uses baseball to explain how the human condition works. Like, something which if I said that, I'm like, that sounds really corny, but it works.
Yeah. So below Emissary.
Yeah. I don't know. How do you feel about it compared to Balance of Terror?
Oh, God. I loved the tension in Balance of Terror. I think, like, that and, you know, I said, oh, I don't mind there not being much space stuff. That is mostly space stuff.
It is mostly space stuff. And then, you know, you have just Mark Leonard and William Shatner's characters just holding that slow respect as they're watching the others, as they're watching the others' moves play out.
Yeah, like, Kor wants this. Kor wants to be like this Romulan commander to Kirk. And he won't ever be.
No.
No.
The Romulan commander's just like, you know, in a different time, I could have called you friend.
I know. Oh, so good.
All right, okay. In the spirit of Trekkian compromise, I am going to say, you know, the new number four.
Cool. Okay, so that's a real good showing, and especially after, having a new last place on the list last episode, having something in the top five is pretty good.
What is going to knock Wrath of Khan?
Well, soon enough, we're going to see another even-numbered Star Trek movie, so who knows? Cool. So, our third and final episode of the night is Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 3, Episode 23, labelled, fittingly enough, Sarek. This aired on the 14th of May 1990, with a teleplay by Peter S. Beagle. Yes, that Peter S. Beagle from The Last Unicorn and the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings. Story also by him, but from an unpublished story by Mark Cushman and Jake Jacobs, and directed by Les Landau. The UK number one hit was Adamski with Killer, and the US had Sinead O'Connor with Nothing Compares to You, which we've covered fairly recently, is a very good track. And Adamski, my word, that hits me with nostalgia. I was 9 when this aired, but I still feel nostalgia for that track. I'm currently reading through the Cyberpunk Red role-playing game. So the 1990 Cyberpunk kind of vibe from Killer was, it was great to listen to. If you've not heard it in a while, give it a go. It's fun. But yeah, Peter S. Beagle,
I've seen the animated movie of The Last Unicorn. I watched it because Christopher Lee is in it, and we watched it shortly after he died. Rene Aubergenois, who plays Odo in Deep Space Nine, also voices a character. Jeff Bridges, plays like the heroic kind of lead, but you could tell that Jeff Bridges is not like, Jeff Bridges was a fantastic actor, but not every good actor can be a good voice actor.
Oh God, let's cast our mind back to Peter Dinklage with Destiny. You know, that was ropey as hell.
I mean, not everyone can be a Christopher Lee.
No. I've not seen the animation of it. I've read the book, and I think it was something that I was preemptively soured on by how unabashed the praise that my writing group were giving for it was. Where I was like,
the book or the film?
The book.
I've actually not read the book. How was it?
It's probably better than I gave it credit for at the time. It's fine. But yeah, again, I think I preemptively knew that I was going to be being stubborn about it. But yeah.
The Japanese animation studio who did this is Topcraft, who would then go on to animate Hayao Miyazaki's film of Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind.
Ooh.
And there's the animated Hobbit and Return of the King for Rankin Bass.
Huh?
The Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings.
Ah.
Those two other animated Tolkien films, which us in the UK did not know about until much later in life.
Oh. Right, so onwards. No unicorns in this one, and no hobbits, is just Sarek. And, you know, other characters.
Other characters. Other characters played by members of the cast. And go.
So, the Enterprise is meeting the mysterious Ligerans and pick up Ambassador Sarek, who's preparing for this talk for over 90 years. Riker and Picard are so excited. They are fanboying out about Sarek. They're in their best scants. Picard once met him at his son's wedding and couldn't speak at all. He sees Sarek's aides, Key Man Dozen, who looks like Peter Mannion from The Thick of It, only slightly more competent, and Saketh, who's a very quiet Vulcan in the background. Key Man Dozen says Sarek's old and easily tired, so he's going to stick to his quarters, if that's all right. And it's a bit of a shame for Picard, because he arranged a concert and everything. He got some photos he wanted him to sign, whole thing. Sarek beams over with his latest she, who is my wife, called Perrin. Wes and Geordi are preparing a slime tank for the Ligerans, and Wesley has a date with a real person. Oh my god. Sarek enters and bitches about the room not being ready yet, even though the Ligerans aren't even here. Riker and Picard both talk about Sarek, how healthy he seems despite his age, and how they both really like him.
Look how good his teeth are and how glossy his coat.
Exactly, yes, that kind of tone. Troy suggests that maybe they ask Perrin about going to the concert. And Picard runs off right away to ask her. Oh, he's so thrilled. And she says that Sarek is aware of him and his career. He then has to hide an erection at that. Perrin says they're unlikely to make the concert and goes to a back room where Sarek is failing to meditate. Oh no. Tank boys start arguing about how Wesley won't really be able to pull, and they almost come to blows before Riker stops them from fighting. At the concert, Riker and Picard both compare chat about people's tempers are getting really out of hand at the moment. There's an unseen D'Amato who's apparently just been a real jerk. Sarek, Perrin, and the assistants show up to watch Data play, and Sarek actually cries during the performance and has to leave, but not before Picard notices this. Crusher confronts Wesley about not showing up at the concert and slaps him. She tells Troy this, and Troy asks, you know, was he being a little bitch? It's like, no more than normal. It's like, damn! Oh my god! Troy says there's been a lot of reports like this. Data takes Saketh on a tour of the bridge and realizes he's being grilled on the capabilities of Troy and Picard to possibly, you know, take over the talks if, say, Sarek's suddenly unable to do it. He evades this when Data brings it up. Down in 10 forward, O'Brien almost picks a fight with a guy over a table, which we're guessing isn't a regular occurrence, but who knows?
Those damn table stealers.
I know, just for worst. Riker talks to Worf about the increase of violence. Worf says, with all of the aptitude for chief of security, I haven't seen anything untoward, just before opening the door and everyone's fighting in 10 forward. Oh, Worf, what are you like? Crusher explains this isn't a virus and it matches with Sarek's arrival. Maybe it's something there. Troy felt something in the concert, something vague, of course. And Picard mentions the crying. Troy says, oh, Sarek looks like he's lost control. Crusher mentions Bendai syndrome, which my autocorrect kept saying was Bendis syndrome. Different thing. This one makes Vulcans lose emotions rather than repeat lines of dialogue.
Bendis, the writer.
Yeah, Bendai for syndrome, not Bendis for writer.
Brian Michael Bendis, the writer.
Yeah. That's the one, the writer. Anyway, yeah, Vulcans lose control of their emotions with Bendai syndrome. They can test for this, but it'll take longer than they've got before the meeting. Key says he's not going to delay the meeting, and Sarek's fine. After all, Key, Sakath, and Perrin aren't affected. Data grills Sakath and tells him, look, you could either be Lord Sarek's dignity or for Federation. And he spills the beans. He says that he's been using his limited telepathic powers to keep Sarek's emotions in check, and the stress for meeting really isn't helping. So why is Sarek ignoring this diagnosis? Why does any old man in a position of authority ignore their mortality and wreck everything for the sake of their own pride? Riker and Picard argue about what to do. Even they're susceptible to Sarek's emotional problems. Luckily, they calm down a bit after that. Perrin is fuming about the accusation, says Bendai is a folktale.
I did like how basically Data stopped them from fighting by basically playing the Mummy Daddy Please Don't Fight card.
Well, I mean, who else would?
Data looks so sad.
Yeah. He doesn't know. That's the worst thing. He doesn't have the emotions. So he just looks at them perplexed and like, oh no, we're fighting in front of the kid again. What's he going to be like when he does get emotions, you know? I need to think of that.
He's going to try and be the funny one to compensate.
Right,
anyway, yeah. I'm going to start the stopwatch.
Yeah, so Sarek walks in and says, no, I'm completely fine. It's like, yeah, you're fine, mate. Why is Sakath keeping you in check? And Sarek, surprised by this, dismisses Sakath rather than going, oh yeah, maybe I do have problems. Picard mentions Sarek crying and he begins to snap. A little more pushing. And he starts yelling at Picard. Yeah, we kind of know you've got a problem here now. Time's getting close for meeting. Picard's going to have to cancel. Perrin mentions, look, this is Sarek's legacy. We knew he was declining and it came on so light, so gradual that we just figured power through one last mission. Maybe there's one way to save him. Do a mind meld. Sarek has his doubts about this. After all, Sarek would gain stability, but Picard would get all the emotions. Picard's still down for this and they meld with Crusher watching. Sarek goes off to the meeting. A new spring in his step, and referring to Riker as number one, where he goes. Picard, on the other hand, is in a dark room shouting and crying in front of Crusher. I've definitely been this way at my most drunk. Never play Drink Catan and Drink Citadels in one night. It is not recommended. Anyway, they have a nice hug, and that's all good. Riker skips ahead to his log, saying Sarek succeeded at his mission. He's going back to Vulcan now. Picard tells Perrin that Sarek does love her, and she knows. Of course she knows. He's a Vulcan, so he may not say it, but, you know. Still, he'll be going off into the West and diminishing. Sarek reckons they won't meet again, and Picard says he reckons they will. And, of course, we know that they will in Unification Part 1, just before Sarek carks it. The end.
1:58.
Okay.
Okay, so the question, the one question, the most important question.
Oh my God.
Do you think Wesley pulled?
No. Of course not. I figure that whatever confidence he had was ruined by this entire incident. The anger with Geordi getting slapped by his mum, the confidence that he had very briefly.
No, the gang slap.
Oh yeah, that was
after the date.
Oh yeah, no. I think he'd been like skipping in and celebrating when Prussia called him in. So you're skipping more than usual, Wesley. Why is this going on? That sort of thing. Yeah, he might have even gone for round two with Geordi and gone like, yeah, fuck you, bitch, I pulled. That kind of thing.
Perhaps he wouldn't shut up about the slime.
Yeah. I mean, he'd just spend the next season walking around going, you know, I am a man now.
Oh, no, Wesley's going to be that guy who always carries a condom in his wallet. To the point where he's just like, let me just open up my wallet, get out my £5 note. Oh, and a condom.
So yes, you have one man who made it through Starfleet Academy with that unused.
even Data pulled at Starfleet Academy.
God. Yeah, it was impressive seeing the scants about. I don't know when they stopped being a thing.
I think they were phased out pretty early.
Yeah, these, I thought they were just like season one things, but yeah, here they are in season three.
They're wearing trousers, so they're not the proper scant.
I guess, yeah. Yeah, they're doing that kind of, was it 90s kind of thing of the skirt and then the trousers kind of thing. And all in their nice kind of formal wear for seeing Sarek. I loved Picard fanning out about Sarek as well.
Yep.
I know he was saying in Unification he had a great deal of respect for the man, but the fact that he and Riker are like, oh my god!
Oh my god, it's Sarek!
He's here!
Squee! Squee!
Yeah, but it was Sarek. It wasn't, we're going to get this way with Spock because you, the audience, all know Spock. It's Sarek, you know, what appeared in one episode and some of the films.
It is always nice to see when Captain Picard gets to have fun, because Captain Picard generally is not having, like, okay, he's not, like, actively miserable, but he's doing his best to be, I am not having fun, so Riker can have fun instead.
Yeah, I get the feeling, watching it through for this show, TNG feels like Picard wanted more hijinks than Picard got a lot of the time. And a lot of people expect stoic Picard. So yeah, but at the same time, stoic Picard's still a human.
Here's the thing. I think Picard just wants every other week to have to go to like a gangster planet and dress up as a gangster and like carry a Tommy gun and like drive a car.
Oh god, yeah, he's always down for that sort of thing. So yeah, it just has to be dad sometimes.
It's like, hey, we're on a hijinks planet. Number one, I've got this.
Yes, you can do hijinks on the Sirius planet. I've got this one.
A planet where they have made mini golf their god. Mr. Worf, get my keys.
Yeah, so it was interesting, cause obviously, as mentioned in the recap, something that's been on my mind with stuff like watching all of Succession, with certain political things, and even the themes of one of the comic scripts I'm putting together at the moment, is that kind of short-sightedness of like the old and powerful to assume that they will live to get forever and just kind of power through their decline no matter the cost to literally everyone else. And here it is kind of seen in, like, manifested in the entire crew of the Enterprise getting fighty as Sarek loses control of his emotions. Yeah, it's almost like, maybe a lot of the Earth burning comes from this sort of attitude.
Yeah, maybe the older generations need to step aside and let the younger generations.
Yeah, maybe. No. But yeah, so it was interesting seeing those themes being explored here in 1990. And the idea of, okay, here's a character that's very stoic, very dignified, all of that, and being confident enough to let the character fall, to let them stumble. And, you know, from what I was reading about this, apparently two different scripts were made. One that featured Sarek as the Vulcan that was doing this and one without, and this is the one they went with. And I feel that to the audience definitely works better. Going like, yeah, this is a person that we know, a person that's established in history, and their dignity is being taken away from them. That can be quite powerful. And, you know, like, this is from around the sort of time that Gene Roddenberry was beginning to kind of decline as well. So that must have been quite an experience doing this and that all at the same time. It's always a rough time when you see that. Yeah. I remember from my mum's admittedly fairly short illness and then passing that, yeah, where you see this person that you go, yeah, this person was a rock, was like, at times in your life you go, shit, yeah, this person is immortal, is this kind of massive thing, and then yeah, they aren't, because all of these people are mortal. You know, I was about to say are human, but we're talking about a Vulcan here.
Yeah.
And yeah, seeing something like Star Trek The Next Generation deal with just with that just as part of their regular week, you know, this is a good episode, and it is powerful seeing that kind of destruction, even if it's manifested through a lot of fights and arguing, you know.
I would say some fantastic acting from Patrick Stewart at the end when he just goes full.
Oh God, yeah.
When he goes full Brian Blessed.
Knowing with the build-up in the first few acts that this is someone that Picard respects so much. You know, you get, again, that kind of the conflict that you had in Journey into Babel with Spock and Sarek going, okay, like, this is someone who has enough of a relationship, albeit mostly parasocial, with Sarek to then have to go
and destroy his career.
Yeah. Like, imagine doing that to someone that was foundational to who you are. Like,
everything.
Yeah. Going like, fuck, if I had to tell, like, I guess it'd be a bit different. I was going to say, if I had to tell Chris Claremont to step off, but frankly, I love the man, but, you know, his work has been shakier and shakier over the years anyway. But yeah, it's an interesting thing to witness in all this.
Like, I don't think that many actors could pull off that last scene.
No.
The way Stewart does. Like, as much as respect I have for Shatner's acting when he's on, I think he would be too angry shouting.
Yes.
And I don't... And the same with Avery Brooks.
Yeah.
Because there's just something about Patrick Stewart where, like, every he can just make every emotion just appear on his face in, like, the blink of an eye. Just the way he goes from just shouting and screaming to just, like, almost laughing hysterically to that last stoic moment where Sarek is, you know, wondering if Amanda and Spock ever knew how much he loved them.
Yeah. I mean, that's, God. Yeah, Mark Leonard sells this so well and feels so frail in this, like he did in Unification as well. But the ability, like when you see him obviously in decline from the start, like trying to cover it up, but not doing well. And then after Mind Meld, where he is a pitch perfect kind of Patrick Stewart / Sarek kind of impression is really good. It's like, oh God, yeah, of course, this is an actor doing acting. This is not like, say, the last couple of seasons of Picard, where you look at Patrick Stewart being JL and going, oh no, you need to sit down and a cup of tea, mate.
We don't talk much about, say, like, use of camera or like actual physical filmmaking, but the Mozart concert where it's the pan across from Sarkaf and just pans across to to Mark Lennon and just a close up as he's crying. Like, I mean, like that's,
yeah,
like Star Trek. I would say, you know, Star Trek is like a lot of TV of this era where it very rarely goes for.
It's not very ambitious.
No, because, you know, it's the nature of the beast. Like, you're having to produce a show at, like, incredible speeds.
Hmm.
You don't have time for anything more revolutionary than, okay, we've got the cameras for the long shots. We've got cameras here for the close-ups. We've done the blocking. Everybody go. So, like, moments when, say, the camera actually moves, and it's not for, like, a fight sequence. It's for just, it is this very slow, dramatic beat. It sells is going on perfectly.
It does a really good job of that. I will say, when I saw Data and the other players in the concert, because I've not seen this episode before, I was like, okay, which one's going to start a fight? I did not expect a more somber moment with Zarek crying. But yeah, it was just like, okay, Data's obviously not going to start a fight, but is the guy behind him just going to go like...
The guy with the beard.
Yeah.
The guy next... I don't know, Data kind of had his... I liked when Data was just kind of moving his... what is it called with the bow? With
violin. Yeah.
He's
bow,
moving in time with the music.
Yeah.
And then, like, he starts playing his most somber face.
Hmm. Yes.
I really wanted O'Brien to punch the guy in the barroom fight for having a blue shirt.
Oh,
I just wanted to be, oh, you blue shirters, always stealing our tables.
Wow. Oh, no. Always getting to go on the missions. Think you're too good for a transporter chief. Kind of stood at his booth.
You know, one day I'll get to go on missions and roll my sleeves up.
Oh, yeah. One day, O'Brien.
And on that day, nothing good will ever happen to me again.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so where do we want to put Sarek on our big list?
Oh, God, like, this is tough.
Like, it's another good one. It's not, like, Journey into Babel good.
No.
But, like, yeah, you can tell this is an episode that had... like some nice emotions, some nice drama.
This is a proper drama.
Yeah.
Like it there's no big fight, there's no threat of cosmic war. It's just these weird aliens who like the slime too much.
Mm. Yeah, we never get to see the aliens that like the slime.
Like are they gonna sit in it? Are they gonna eat it? Like it looked like the mood slime from Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah, yeah, and it like when they mentioned a slime pit, I was just thinking of I think it was Master of the Universe, like the old He-Man toys.
Oh yeah,
had
a
slime pit. Slime pit. So it was like, yeah, stick your things in there. It's like I think we had a pit. Like the slime got used up. We never replaced it. But yeah, okay, so looking at drama here, Unification also featuring your boy, Sarek's at 24.
Oh, I went to number 17, Necessary Evil, Odo Dozen Noir, which Sarek is not as good. Okay, I'm biased because I love me a good neo-noir.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But these are both good character dramas in their own way.
Yes. Yeah, I think you might be right. Like, this is a very good character piece. Necessary Evil does a very good character piece for most of the characters in DS9 and Odo Does a Noir, which is, I think, for most I've enjoyed Odo aside from the explosion. Okay, below that we've got Yesterday's Enterprise, which is, again, another very good episode, even if everyone's kind of out of sorts and from a different timeline. Oh, in fact, both of these episodes did something which I made note of. 10 Forward with all of the lights on is really weird.
Oh, yeah, it looks like...
it's so jarring.
Yeah.
And they did it in Yesterday's Enterprise because it was just a mess hall. But here, it's like, yep, house lights up. It's like, oh, God, that's what it looks like.
No one's having a fun time. It looks just most like a set.
No one has a fun time in 10 Forward when all the lights are on. You got the mood lighting for a reason.
Like, that's when, like, the DJ stops and Guinan's like, everyone out.
And Guinan wasn't there. I assume she wouldn't let them do that if she was there.
See, let's be honest. If Guinan was there, she'd be using her hat like a Mortal Kombat weapon.
And she's got a fucking gun back there. Like, it is for the best of everyone that she was somewhere else.
we may live in a post-scarcity utopian society of which this is the flagship, but I've got a fucking gun.
Yeah, gonna end some people. Okay, I think yesterday's Enterprise, while it lacks the emotional depth of this, it's not without emotion and is a stunning one shot of an episode. I think this might be better than Death Wish, though.
Yeah.
Which, again, very good, but...
Death Wish is really good, especially with Q, a character I find irritating very quickly.
Yeah, he's best used sparingly.
He's either best used sparingly or not allowed to, or it's not allowed to be, it shouldn't be a comedy episode.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so are we putting it at the number 19?
Yes.
Yeah, cool. Okay, which just about keeps a Star Trek Voyager episode in the top 20. I've just realised.
Well, it's also like that Enterprise episode in the top 20. Do you think there ever will?
I live in hope.
Yeah.
That's the thing. We rag on Enterprise sometimes, not as much as Picard and not as much as Disco, but I would love to see all of them, probably not Picard though, in the top 20 in some form. Or at least in the top, like,
I don't know. I think there's at least one episode of Picard which I think might rank top 20.
Ooh, okay.
The season 3 Picard episode when they think they're all going to die and they have to come to terms with that.
Oh, God, yeah, we'll have to do that at some point. But not today. Today we have ranked now up to 151, meeting the Section 31 movie where we left it. In the 151st place, and
are we gonna knock it down another 3 spots on the list until next episode?
No, it will only confuse me at some point when I don't remember. So that's it for us. We're going to go and I don't know, punch a wall and call it Father or something. Something cathartic.
Father.
And so next time, Miles, what are we doing?
What we'll be doing?
Yes.
Miles and Charlie discuss the podcast.
That's correct. We're finally making time to watch Darmok. I can't wait. So yes, that'll be our next show. But until then, if you like what we do and want to direct us to an individual episode, character or theme, you can always donate some money at our Ko-fi and suggest it there, and we'll build an episode around it. Until I actually pull my finger out and get a Patreon on, this is going to be the best value way to get an episode of your choice. So that's ko-fi.com/casualtrek. You can also find us on casualtrek .bsky.social for our blue sky. And Miles, where can the good folks find you?
They can find me at my blog at mareedlobato.wordpress.com or my blue sky at milesreedlobato.bsky.social.
Nice. I can be found on skyshark.bsky.social for my blue sky. And fakedtales.com, where I am I've restarted my 2000 AD year-by-year retrospective. I'm reading up to 84 currently and have posted probably 77 and 78 by the time this airs. And Who Dares Rolls for something. I should actually hit publish on some of them. Who knows what? Anyway...
Who dares rolls, more like who dares knows.
Hey. That's us. And until next time, go do a Starfleet. It'll make your dad proud. Or even if it doesn't make your dad proud, frankly, sod that guy.
Eat a jelly baby, and if your dad doesn't approve of who you are, fuck him, you're in the right.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Casual Trek, a Nerd and Tie podcast, presented by Charlie Etheridge Nunn and Miles Reed Lobato. Music by Alfred Etheridge Nunn. Edited by the hosts and by Rihanna Reed Lobato. Star Trek is owned by Paramount. Not us. Not yet.